The most predictive independent variable in this whole equation is age. And age, by definition, is getting closer to death. You're having to, like, you're decaying. Your body is decaying, and you're losing resources. You're becoming weaker. Your immune system's becoming weaker. You're losing muscle. Your hormones are shifting. Your bone density, you're more catabolic than you are anabolic, and you're heading towards death, essentially. Well, if you're 80 years old and you get in a car crash, you're much more likely to die from that car crash than if you're 20 years old. The same thing for everything else. So yes, of course it makes sense. The older you are, the more likely you are to die from this. Well, that's a pretty logical virus, and not all of them follow that trend, like we were saying. So if you know that, then you go, okay, well, what I can do then is to make myself physiologically the youngest I can, right?
What's up, my friend? I'm health expert Ted Rice, and I'm back again with another episode for you, helping you through this crazy coronavirus time that we're living in. And I'm super excited to bring this episode to you today because I want to ask you a few questions. Have you been struggling with sleep? Have you been struggling with stress? Do you feel a little on edge? Do you feel a little uncertain? What's going to happen? What's happening with the infection rate? What's happening with the economy? What's happening with my health? Am I going to be okay? Is my family going to be okay? Is the world going to be okay? Is my job going to be secure? Probably just a few of the questions that you have. And today I want to tell you this. I've got a special guest on, and we're going to dive into coronavirus information. Actually, we're going to be diving into how to calm down your stress levels and how to get better sleep, because I've got former Navy SEAL and current medical doctor, Kirk Parsley, back on the show. And Kirk, it's been a while since I've had him on, but he's a guest from before. Such a great time to connect with him again. Not only is he a great dude, but he's just super knowledgeable. And obviously with his medical training and his situation being in the SEAL team, he's been through stuff like this before. And he, more importantly to you, and to me for that matter, is that he knows how to help coach you through it. And that's what you're gonna get today. Dr. Kirk Parsley coaching you through how to navigate the stress of this coronavirus situation. And we're gonna dive into the statistics, where you should be getting your information from and where you shouldn't be getting your information from. And also, if you've been having trouble falling asleep or staying asleep, you're gonna learn a lot from this episode. And I wanna say this before we jump into the interview, I wanna tell you, I am launching a 7-day challenge. So if you want to take advantage of a 7-day coaching event that's going to take your results to the next level. So it's only 7 days long, but I'm promising you this, you will get results in 7 days, and you'll learn what to do after the 7 days to stay on track to get better results than probably what you've gotten ever from paid programs. And this is free. But here's the thing, two things really. Number one, there's only a limited number of spots. And you can go to legendarylifepodcast.com/challenge to join. The other thing is, this isn't a quick fix. If you're a person who's not particularly motivated and you join free things and then drop off, don't join. It's not for you. But if you're a person who's high performance, you're type A, you know you need to take your health and fitness to the next level, you know you need to focus on it, especially right now, and you want to learn some next level information that will help you not just to get results in 7 days, but will help you every day afterward, go to legendarylifepodcast.com/challenge. Again, only 50 spots available for this, and we're going to hold you to a high standard. So that's what we do on this show. So you know where to join, legendarylifepodcast.com/challenge. Without further ado, let's get to the interview with Dr. Kirk Parsley. Kirk Parsley, so great to have you back on the show, man.
Ted Rice, long time. Is it Rice or Reese? Do you say Rice or Reese?
Rice.
Rice, okay, yeah.
I appreciate you asking.
I've actually seen this name a few times, like 3 or 4 times in my life, and I swear it's like 50-50, like Rice or Reese. It seems to be like the more Greek your heritage, it's Reese, and if
you're more the American aspect is rice. I don't know, whatever.
From the UK, Kirk.
From the UK?
Yeah. We're that's my best UK accent, which is not really that great, but we looked, and it's been 5 years since we have talked and had you on the show, but it couldn't come at a better time because we're in the quarantine situation.
Yeah.
And even though that will date this podcast, we're going to be talking about so many important things that are relevant to after this situation ends. And let's start off like this, man. You know, I've already slapped on the intro and talked about, you know, your Navy SEAL background and how you're the sleep doctor and, you know, you have this sleep supplement out. But let's talk about how you're managing yourself in the hopes that people can hear how you're looking at the data because you're a medical doctor.
Right.
And you're a former Navy SEAL, total badass. And you're keeping yourself straight and also helping others, helping your consulting clients keep themselves straight. So just can you bring us up to speed on what's happening in your world?
Yeah. I mean, so, you know, for me, and I remember enough about your background. I know that you've been through some hellacious times as well. And, you know, I think that gives you perspective, right? You know, so I grew up like literally dirt poor with no shoes, you know, and joined the Navy and became a SEAL and saw lots of dangerous crap in the SEAL teams and, you know, lots of bad situations and, you know, lived through volcanoes and hurricanes and, you know, all the military stuff, obviously just on its own. And you know, then became a medical doctor, went to medical school. So, you know, so I've been through this like high stress, high demand, your decisions are critical. Keeping your head is the difference between completely collapsing and making a fool of yourself and harming people, even getting people killed. I have a lot of training and keeping my head in a stressful situations. And I think it's just kind of my nature anyway. I'm a pretty, everything's going to be all right guy, you know? So when I first heard about this, virus, you know, that immediately what I always do is I always look at a precedent, right? So, you know, when we first started this whole thing, we only had China's data and, you know, there's obviously lots of justifiable reasons to question China's data. So, we didn't really know a whole lot, but we knew something, right? And, you know, we at least thought we had it within an order of magnitude, which it turns out we might not have, you know, it might be 10 orders of magnitude when it's all said and done. But, you know, I go back, I look at the precedents, and then the thing that I always come back to, no matter how dire the situations are, is there's usually not that many options, right? Right now there's nothing else to do. There's nowhere else to go. There's nothing more we can do. And so you go, well, that sounds scary. Like, okay, some people are going to die. Let's just admit that. If coronavirus weren't here, some people are still going to die. In fact, about 16 million people have died worldwide since January 1st. And about 90,000 of those have been coronavirus. So if you take that number, then you have a 99.5% chance of dying of something other than coronavirus. So let's keep it in perspective, right? Go, yes, this is novel. Yes, we're having a hard time treating it. Yes, it's scary. We don't know how contagious it is. We don't know if it's airborne. We don't know how long it lasts. We don't know if there'll be durable immunity after exposure. Lots of stuff we don't know. What can you do about any of that stuff? Nothing. You can make good decisions, collect the data, try to be rational about it, and see what, you know, nobody understands pandemics when you're in it, right? We didn't understand H1N1 when we were in the swine flu of 2008-2009. And you know, that 2009 season, that was projected to kill millions of Americans, you know, and it ended up killing about 25,000, which is still more than coronavirus has, but it's different and scary. And I think the media and the social media is so fast right now, and everybody's so loose. I mean, I don't think that there's ever been 100% objective media, But what I've noticed in the last, you know, 4 or 5 years of my life is like, I have no idea what's true in just the general sense. Because if you watch one news outlet, they will literally say the polar opposite, the exact opposite that another news network is saying. And I'm like, well, how do I know which one is true, right? And it's not just the narrative. Like, of course, they've always spun the narrative, but they change the facts, you know? The facts, like the sound bites they use, and they take things out of context. And I'm not saying that anybody's doing anything deliberate. I think that everybody's scared. And in fear, you know, some people, you know, what the research shows in psychology is that, you know, there's that old saying that misery loves company.
Mm.
What actually turns out to be true when you do the research is misery loves miserable company. So like if you put people in a room and you make them miserable somehow, like say, hey, you know, you're going to have to go in and get disciplined by the dean of the school or something. So wait in this room. And then you put some other people in another room and like they can just, you know, they're just in there like having cookies and drawing on the whiteboard or something. Like there's no real purpose, or they're just kind of hanging out, watching TV and stuff. And then you bring someone else in, like you have a room full of miserable people and you have a room full of happy people. And if you give the miserable news to somebody, they go sit with the miserable people. They don't go sit with the people partying. So misery loves miserable company. In fact, we've all experienced like being in a really bad situation and being completely pissed off that people are like celebrating and happy around us, because you're like, man, like you're really like, it's really hard to be around your cheer and joy right now when I'm, you know, when my dog just died 5 minutes ago or something, you know, or, you know, I just got fired or I'm going through bankruptcy or whatever, like whatever's making you miserable. You know, we've all experienced that. Yeah, I'd rather be around some sedate energy. So I think you know the media is doing a lot of that. You know, they're feeding each other, and it's almost as if exposing the worst case scenario as an inevitability is somehow comforting to them, because hey, we're thinking about the worst and we're going to make it through the absolute worst, right? Like we're going to do what we can to survive the absolute worst. And yeah, no, I'm not saying whose philosophy is right or wrong, but you know, my personal preference is to say, okay, well, what do we actually know? What has already happened, and what do we know about what's happening right now? So, like I said, I go back, I look at, you know, the 1918 flu. That was a swine flu as well. And then you know, we have the 2009, and you know, much more recent, relevant. You look at SARS, look at MERS, like you can go back and look through these things and go, okay, what happened? What were the predictions? That's the interesting thing. What were the models saying then? Oh, millions and millions of people are going to die. 25,000 died. That's not millions. That's nowhere close to millions, right? And so that's what I started doing. And I just started going to, you know, the information sources, and I just look it up. So like, you know, I have it on my screen right now behind you. So I go to Worldometer, and like I was saying, 1.5 million cases of coronavirus worldwide. So that's, again, that number out of context sounds actually worse than it is, because that's not true. There's 1.5 million positive tests in the world, but there's only 1.1 million people that currently have it, right? Because 350,000 people have already recovered from it. And then you go down and you look at this other box, and it says, or out of the 1.1 million people who have it, 1,059,000 of them have a mild condition, meaning that they don't need any medical attention whatsoever, other than maybe just to be reassured and sent home. So that's 96% of all cases worldwide. And only 4 to 5% of those become serious or critical. And then you go, okay, well, if only 45%, or if only 4 to 5% are serious or critical, those are the ones that move over to possible deaths. And about 20% of those die. So 1 out of 5. So essentially 1% of the total number of people are dying. And that's if we knew everybody who had it. And there's no way we do, right? We know there's at least twice, probably 10 times the number of people who have it, which, you know, twice takes it down to 0.5, and, you know, 4 times would take it down to 0.25, which would be like the flu, right? So again, I'm not saying it is like the flu. I'm not saying that we shouldn't be concerned, but let's look at what we actually know. And this is what we actually know. And all we really know is deaths. We know new deaths and we know total deaths pretty well. Not everybody's recording them the same. In the U.S., if you have a positive coronavirus test, then you died from coronavirus, you know, regardless of how you died. So that's different than, say, like in Europe, where they're saying, well, you know, it's an 85-year-old in congestive heart failure who came in and got intubated. And then when he died, we tested and he had, okay, maybe coronavirus was a contributor and it might not have been. Because if you go to a hospital for a week and you go into a fairly intensive care unit, whether it's a strict ICU or just like a heavily monitored, like you go to where there's really sick people, you're going to get coronavirus, which is why they tell old people to stay away from hospitals. Like, you're going to get whatever's going around. And so we have a pretty good idea of what the new and total deaths are. And then the number we have the best on is active cases and not active cases, because those get lost, but serious and critical cases. So if you look at the serious and critical cases, I mean, America has had almost 2,000 people die 2 days in a row. That sounds really scary. But compared to what? Compared to all other causes of death, it's still, you know, it's still not making up the majority of deaths. And it would have to go year round. I mean, I think like 1,700, maybe 1,000 people die a day of cancer, but that's 365 days a year, right? Like, it's not,
right.
It's not just for this flu season or, you know, however long this turns out to be. But if you look at the serious and critical cases, like we're saying, those are the only ones that might die, right? The mild people aren't going home and dying. The people who are getting admitted might die. So the serious and critical cases, that's our only potential death pool. We've only gone up about 150 to 200 cases per day for the last week. So it took us about a month to get to 8,000 cases. And then since, you know, the last 2 weeks, we've added 1,000 over 2 weeks, essentially. So we're only getting, even in these days where we're having 2,000 people die, we're only adding 150 to 200 cases that day. Well, if the serious and critical are the only people at risk for death, we don't even have 10,000 of those. So we can't have that many 2,000 days without a lot more people becoming serious and critical, and that's not happening. So nothing to say, you know, not arguing at all about whether you should be scared or should you social distance or like all of that other stuff. I'm not talking about that. Like, I let people make up their own mind. I don't have anything to do with policy. I have no, you know, education in that area. I'm not even an epidemiologist, but I can just look at the numbers and say, well, if this is the possible dead pool here, right? Of 10,000, it's not even quite 10,000. And that's only growing by 100 a day. Or 200 a day. Well, if, you know, 5% of those are dying, right? I mean, you're only talking about 10 people a day for like every day you're adding, and 200 cases, like that doesn't make any sense. You know, let's talk about what's actually happening. Models suck. I mean, that's you know, very astute, highly educated mathematicians will tell you that models are all wrong. Like, all models are wrong. They're all approximations.
They're a good guide,
right?
But they're not accurate.
So,
right?
Yeah. You know, what we're doing with a model is we're looking at what happened yesterday or the last couple of weeks, and we're saying, if this continues, this is what that will look like. But there's a lot of assumptions in there. Like, how contagious is this? Well, you know, that's something called the R naught, right? Like, how, if you have it or I have it, how many other people will we infect? Well, if it's less than one, if it's like 0.5, well, then that thing's dead before, like, that's a non-issue, right? Because, you know, the current people aren't even going to infect that many more current people. If it's 5, well, then that grows exponentially super quick, right? Every one person's giving it to 5 people. Well, under what conditions? Are you living in New York City? Or are you living in a 1,000-acre ranch in Wyoming? Like, how many people do you even have exposure to?
Right.
You know, how good is your immune system? How long are you contagious for? And then, you know, so I talk about, well, there's a lot of assumptions going to these models. And what happens is models get progressively more accurate with the more information we know. Well, we don't really know very much until we get really far down the road, and then we understand the disease really well, and then the models aren't really necessary because we understand the disease, but then the models are really good at predicting the future with a long enough history of saying, well, this happened and that happened and this, and so if they see the peak and see it coming back down, well, then they can extrapolate that back down, and if they see another one coming up, they can extrapolate that. But you know, they're a useful exercise to plan for the worst case scenario to see what can you do. And so that's one thing. It's just what's actually happening versus what they're saying might happen. And if you're, and I just tell people, don't look at the news. Like, don't go to the news. Just get your information from academic sites. If you do,
you name a few sources? Like, should people? Yeah. So Worldometer.
Worldometer is a great one. Yeah. The Euro CDC is really good. They have a lot of graphs. They have a lot more information on the European countries. Worldometer is my favorite. That's Worldometer. So it's worldometer.info. There's all sorts of great data on there. You can look at the population of every country. You can look at the average age of kind of like, you can, there's a death ticker and a birth ticker. It's telling you like how quickly the world's growing, how many people have died across the entire world. Like it's for a geek like me, it's fascinating. I can spend hours and hours like digging and coming up with hypotheses and doing research. Johns Hopkins has a website that's specifically tracking coronavirus. Worldometer has its own coronavirus category, but it also has just a population category where you can just look up anything you want to know about a country. And in the coronavirus case, you can actually search by country. And when you click on the US, it actually lists it out by state. And it's lots of information. So that's a good place to go. And again, look at what's currently happening, which is the same thing I tell people. If you're addicted to the news and you feel like you really just got to go, if you got to go to your news,
got to stay informed.
If you got to go, you got to go to CNN and be informed, or whatever your preference is. I tell people, pay attention to emotionally charged words, right? And by pay attention to them, I mean, don't let them get in. Realize that they're there and go, oh, that's manipulation. So if something's skyrocketing or something's plummeting or something's crumbling or something is, you know, spinning out of control or like whatever phrases they want to use, go, okay, well, what does that mean? So I remember early on they said, testing, you know, new cases of coronavirus skyrocket in America.
Skyrocketing,
yeah. Skyrocketed. And we went from like 20,000 to 30,000. And that was a skyrocket. Like, well, I'm not sure that's a skyrocket, right? I mean, that's an increase, but the more people we test, the more cases we're going to have, right? That's just right. Plain and simple. If we tested 330 million people, we would have millions of cases right now. So we know that's the case. So you know, look at the denominator, like compared to what? 3,000 people have died this month of coronavirus. Wow, that seems like a lot, man. We only had like 2 deaths a month ago. All right. During that same time, 10,000 other people have died in America, right? Then what have they died from? So relative.
And what you said earlier about like if you, in the US, if you have a complicated condition like congestive heart failure and you died but tested positive. So that's what's happening too.
Yeah. And if you look at young, healthy people, and this is where I think the social media really causes a lot of harm with this because everybody gets to throw out their dialogue and it's their narrative. I'm not saying they're lying. I'm not saying they're being manipulative. It's a lot of times it's heartfelt. Like this is truly coming out of them. This is what they're really seeing. This is how they're seeing the world. But narrative controls everything, right? Like the senses, you know, they provide a sensation, but our brain interprets it and makes meaning out of it. And so we all do meaning differently. And so some people look at the numbers and go, wow, that's really reassuring. And some people look at the numbers and go, oh my God, look at all those deaths, right? And so when you have something like social media and you just have people putting their narratives out all the time, people are getting really scared about these so this whole thing is a black swan event, right? But, you know, in medical school, they always say, if you hear hoofbeats, look for horses, don't look for zebras, right? Well, the media, especially social media, is fantastic for grabbing attention for zebras. And they're presented as other horses. So, you know, when you see 30-year-olds and 40-year-olds going on ventilators and, you know, healthcare workers dying and otherwise healthy and all this stuff. well, that sounds really scary. Now people are actually afraid of dying. You know, if we're honest, that's all we're afraid of, right?
Because
right? If this were just, hey, everybody's going to get a really bad cough and have a fever for a week,
you're going to get the sniffles. Right.
No, nothing, like nobody's even going to slow down for that, right? Like you're going to slow down when you're sick and then you're like, nobody's going to give it a second thought. It's like, oh man, it's going to suck when I get it, but I know I'm going to be all right. So everybody's really worried about death. So all the anxiety is like, you're going to die or somebody you care about is going to die, right? And not to say there's not empathy where, you know, we care that people across the world we don't even know are dying. You know, of course, you know, loss of life is sad and tragic, but it's also part of life. Like by definition, life includes death. Nobody gets out of this alive. It's 100% fatal. Everybody's dying. But, you know, let's keep it in perspective. And, you know, I heard this statistic, it was on a podcast, but a really reliable source. This is like, a syndicated news organization. They have a podcast and they were saying that, I want to say the total number of people who have died in New York that are otherwise healthy and have no comorbidities is 46.
46 people, right?
46 people total. But everybody's aware of the one ER doctor who is intubated and died, or the 30-year-old nurse, or, you know, whatever those cases are, like that sticks. And people start worrying about, well, crap, they're probably healthier than me. Like maybe I'm going to die, you know? And so, you know, there's comfort in the numbers. There's always outliers.
Yeah.
You know, and H1N1, I mean, sadly, H1N1 killed almost as many children as it killed elderly, right? So it had like this biphasic attention, virology. So it really got to people at both ends of the spectrum. It didn't kind of kill the, you know, the 20 to 50 year olds. Those were the safest people. And, you know, I'd rather have this. And I think most elderly people would rather have this, right? Everybody's talking about, oh, we're going to lose the greatest generation. It's like, well, those people have been sacrificing themselves for the country their whole lives. Like this is normal for them. There's not a single one of them who would say, oh, take my grandchild instead of me.
Right.
Every one of them would be like, no, like I'm 80, man. I'm like, I can go. It's all good, man. So I do that. And then I say, if you go to the news stations, pay attention to the denominator, pay attention, like it's compare everything. Every number should be compared to something. They don't tell you what it's compared to, then it doesn't matter. If you don't know the denominator, it doesn't matter. Like 90,000 deaths worldwide sounds huge. 90,000 deaths out of 16 million deaths does not sound huge, right?
Right.
It's just a super small number. It just is. So pay attention to the denominator, pay attention to the emotionally charged words. And then I would only pay attention to news station or to news stories that actually say, this is what happened. Here are the facts we know.
Providing context.
Right.
Yeah. Instead of emotional.
Anything else about where this is going. This expert predicts that. I don't care. Nobody's right. There's not a single person who's right now. That, you know, being old and wise does not allow you to see the future. That's why it's called the future. It doesn't allow you to predict the unexpected. That's why it's called the unexpected. You aren't expecting this to happen. What wisdom allows you to do is put old knowledge onto current situations and say, like, historic knowledge of, well, I'm really educated in this area and I know how this has unfolded historically. It looks a lot like this. So here are the current concerns. It doesn't mean that's what's going to happen. Like here are the current concerns. If they could predict the future, I mean, they wouldn't be human, right? I mean, so no one can predict the future. Nobody can plan for black swan events. That's the definition of them. Things can be totally unexpected. And so you can listen to the experts as saying, well, what we know about airborne viruses is that if we do this, compared to all of the other airborne viruses we know of, this tends to decrease how quickly this spreads. And to be honest, if you really get into the data, we don't know that social distancing is going to help. We suspect it will. Logically, it seems like it will, right? You're just going to interact with your people if you're sheltering in place. That's not, of course, always true. I mean, people live in high density apartment buildings and you're getting takeout three or four times a day. They live with five or six people. I mean, you can limit it to some extent, but you know, this social distancing isn't a new concept. This has been around for 100 years. It's been in the literature.
And in 1918, during the Spanish flu, right?
Right. Yeah. And when you look at the CDC's website, and go to the CDC's website, and you can look at the pandemic plan. So you know, it's not like nobody's ever thought to plan for this. Just we don't know what to do because we don't know what we're going to need because we don't know what the pandemic is going to be. But if it's like a flu, this is what we do. And if it's like whatever radiation event, this is what we do. If it like, and so there are plans for this. And if you look, they break these plans into categories. So there's category one all the way up to category five. And in a category one pandemic, they're predicting, well, they're saying based on the prediction of we could have this many deaths, like what's the max total death? That tells you what category you're in. And so the lowest category is like 90,000, and the highest category, category five, is over 2 million. So that's a pretty broad range. So at the 90,000, they talk about, do we close schools? Do we do social distancing? Do we quarantine people who are sick? Do we? And there's recommendations. Well, categories one, two, and three, none of the recommendations that we're currently doing yet. The only thing those categories really say is, hey, if you're really sick, stay home. If you have a big outbreak at work, like take these measures to prevent other people from getting it and send people home and do these other things. Those are our recommendations. When you get to categories four and five, they recommend doing everything. Well, we're doing everything. We're doing everything in category five. We're already doing it. So now the only other control you have is taking care of yourself. And so that's when I'm talking to people about their own wellness. Because you know, the most predictive independent variable in this whole equation is age. And age, by definition, is getting closer to death. You're having you're decaying. Your body is decaying and you're losing resources. You're becoming weaker. Your immune system's becoming weaker. You're losing muscle. Your hormones are shifting. Your bone density, you're more catabolic than you are anabolic, and you know you're heading towards death essentially. Well, if you're 80 years old and you get in a car crash, you're much more likely to die from that car crash than if you're 20 years old. And the same thing for everything else. So yes, of course it makes sense. The older you are, the more likely you are to die from this. Well, that's a pretty logical virus, and not all of them follow that trend, like we were saying. So if you know that, then you go, okay, well, what I can do then is to make myself physiologically the youngest I can, right? Because I'm 50 years old. I just turned 50 years old during this whole mess. Like my birthday was supposed to be a couple of weeks ago.
Happy belated birthday, man.
Had a lake house and everything. It all got canceled.
Right.
But you know, I'm 50 years old and that's my chronological age. There's nothing I can do. I can't be 30 because I want to be 30. I can't identify as a 30-year-old and be a 30-year-old, right? That's not the way the world works. But yeah. I hope that my physiologic age is less than 50, right? Because that's just an average. Like, what does the average 50-year-old look like hormonally and metabolically, physically, strength, body composite, like all the metrics we can do to sort of say what your age looking like. I hope that I'm, you know, maybe metabolically 40, right? I don't know.
How would you measure that? Or is there really a reliable way to measure your biological age? People say. This episode is sponsored by Organifi. Do you want to know a secret that all my coaching clients follow? It's really simple, but powerful. Add vegetables into each meal. But let's be honest, most of us, including myself, don't eat the recommended servings of vegetables and fruits each day. So for those of us who are on the go or have trouble eating healthy, having a greens powder makes it easy to get your greens in every single day, no matter how busy you are. And that's why I use and recommend Organifi Green Juice, a superfood powder that you just add water to so that you can get your greens in even when you're on the go. The best thing about Organifi Green Juice is that it actually tastes great. But don't believe me, try it for yourself. And use the code TED20, that's capital T-E-D, the number 20, at www.organifi.com. That's Organifi.com to receive 20% off your first order. But hurry, this is a limited time discount for Legendary Life listeners. Now, back to the episode.
the best biological age is looking at DNA.
A telomere length or?
Yeah, so telomere length is one of them. And then there's also something called methylation of the DNA. So that's kind of the damage. So the slightly damaged areas in the DNA, those have methyl groups on them. So that's called methylation. And there's a pattern and frequency of those that are associated with being alive for a certain amount of time. And it, like telomere length, it's an average. So you think of it like you think about body composition, like what's lean? What does it mean to be fat, right? When are you fat? When are you overweight? When are you obese? These are arbitrary numbers. And then, you know, as society gets fatter, like you're right. Like if you,
your standard shift. Yeah.
If you were 15% body fat at, 20 years old, when I was a kid, or, you know, the generation before me, you were fat. I mean, that was like, you were the fat kid. I mean, you're just soft and doughy. You couldn't see your muscles. You couldn't see your abs. Like, you know, and now like a 15% body fat teenager is really common. Right. And so like, so again, all of this is being compared to the relative age of societies and what we've seen. So we take an average of everybody who's 50 and say, okay, this is their telomere length and this is how many methylation groups they have damage to, how many methylations they have in this pattern in this region. And so your metabolic age is this, and you can do it to some extent with things like hormones, if you're not on hormone replacement therapy, or if you're not on peptides that are affecting your hormones, then you can put some metabolics in there, metabolomics, I think they call it. And you can get some sort of idea. But the point is, like, why aren't kids having a problem with this right now? Because they have really good immune systems, right? They have really robust immune systems. This is completely novel, but they have really robust immune systems. Kids are highly anabolic and they're young. By definition, they're young. So that's wrapped into them getting this virus and not really necessarily showing any symptoms at all. And then if they do get any symptoms, it's super mild and it goes away really quickly. So we want to be like a kid, right? We want the youngest immune system we can get. Well, again, I can't make myself chronologically younger, but I can take care of myself and say, all right, well, what could I be doing that's interfering with my immune system? So if you think about your immune system as like an army, every unit you send out to do something else is a unit that you can't use to fight the coronavirus when you get it, right? And we're all going to get it. We're all going to be exposed to this. Like, there's no way around that. We're all going to be exposed to it. Probably is a reasonable chance over half of us have already been exposed to it. We don't know. We'll find out later. But if you can say, all right, well, I want the best immune system I can possibly have. I want to look to this virus as like a 12-year-old, right?
Sure.
I'm not going to eat foods that are causing a gut inflammation that are then going to take a couple of units of my army to go fight off this inflammation in my gut because I've eaten some food with an antigen in it, like an antigenic food that's irritating my gut and causing, you know, me inflammation down there. I'm not going to drink copious amounts of alcohol because that's inflammatory. I'm not going to do, you know, CrossFit blitz till I puke workouts because that's inflammatory. I'm going to take care of myself. I'm going to control my stress. The number one thing for immune system is stress. What I tell people all the time, fight or flight, most people know, is that's the maximum stress. That's maximal stress hormones. And we usually use cortisol because it's easy to talk about. Big molecule, easy to track. Only comes from one source, so that's an easy one. There are other hormones involved, but cortisol, maximum fight or flight. When is cortisol lowest?
In the nighttime.
Deep sleep. Stages 3 and 4, slow wave sleep. It's exactly the opposite. If you think about it, when you get into fight or flight, your pupils dilate, you start taking in a bigger field of vision, but you're just hyper-focused on one thing. Your brain actually kind of shuts down. You don't have rational thoughts. You need to be impulsive to get out of this situation.
That prefrontal cortex, right?
Prefrontal gets cortex shuts off. Down. It's like, it's gone. Like, ask somebody in a gunfight for their phone number. No chance. No chance they know it, right? Ask them to solve 2 + 7. No chance. Zero chance. So if they're in fight or flight, the pupils are dilated, they're hyper-focused, brain shutting down, bronchial trees dilate, they're taking in more air, heart rate goes up, blood pressure goes up, cortisol starts releasing stored glycogen, blood glucose goes up, resting muscle neurotension increases, reflexes get faster, pain threshold goes up, peripheral dilation, blood flow goes to our limbs and our skin to make us super acute, super aware of everything. It gives us the most energy, the most awareness, the most resources to get out of that, you know, to either fight or flee or freeze. If you're so far gone that that's all you can do is just freeze. Like all of that's protective. Well, why wouldn't you run around like that all the time? Like, wouldn't that be great to have 30% more strength and faster reflexes and more lung volume and broader? Like, why wouldn't we do that all the time?
The cost, right? The cost to the immune system.
The cost. It's a cost to everything. So everything else isn't happening. Digestion isn't happening. Your immune system doesn't exist. Why would it? It doesn't make any sense.
Right.
Like, it doesn't matter if you can.
You're not worried about a bacteria when the saber-tooth tiger is about to eat you.
Yeah, if the tiger gets you, it doesn't matter if you have an infection. And, you know, it doesn't matter if your ankle's broken and you still have to run and get away from it. You know, all that repair stuff, your digestion, sexual reproduction, just your ability to produce sperm and ova, producing sex hormones, which, you know, several of them are actually anabolic, obviously. So, fight or flight is actually a catabolic state. You have used all of your stored resources to get you out of this finite period of time. So if you stay like that all the time, you'll die really quickly because you'll run out of resources because you're catabolic. The maximum anabolic state, deep sleep, exactly the opposite, right? Your eyes are closed. You're barely breathing. Your heart rate's low. Your blood pressure's low. You aren't using your muscles. You aren't focusing on anything. You aren't paying attention. There's no need to worry about pain or discomfort or anything like that. You're sleeping. You're comfortable. You're at ease. That's the most anabolic you can be. And that's when your immune system is functioning at its highest. So if you don't sleep well, you don't get good immune function. In fact, if you short sleep yourself by 25%, so if you sleep 6 hours instead of 8 hours, you lose about 30% of natural killer cells. That's a pretty big deal, man. You run into other immunomodulations. You start increasing the cytokines that are associated with pain and inflammation and decreasing the ones that are associated with repair and regeneration and, you know, laying down collagen and exporting trash and all that other stuff. So you impair your immune system by not sleeping well. And the other part is, you know, we signed this contract that we don't remember signing. Well, we signed two contracts, right? So one of them was we're going to die. Like the day we're born, yep, you're going to die. No way around that. The other contract you sign is that you need 8 hours of sleep to restore your body. Now, obviously, when you're younger, you need more. But you need 8 hours of sleep to restore and replenish your brain and your body. Well, what if you don't sleep 8 hours? I mean, if the sole purpose of sleep is to repair and regenerate my body and brain from today, I'm going to sleep tonight so that I can go into tomorrow with a restored, regenerated, rejuvenated brain and body. Well, if I don't sleep, tomorrow still comes. And so where am I going to get that resource from? Exactly the same place that you got your resources for fight or flight. Not to the same level, but to, like, you're going to have more stress hormones and you're going to be more catabolic because you have to be. You didn't repair, you didn't replenish, you didn't store you didn't partition your fuel, you didn't digest everything, you didn't produce enough sex hormones, you didn't fight off enough of the infection, you didn't decrease enough of the inflammation, you didn't flush enough waste products out of your brain. And what that leads to is a decreased prefrontal cortex, because we already said when you're maximum stress, this doesn't work at all, right? I mean, it's not online whatsoever. But what if you're halfway to fight or flight? You probably have half of that function. And if you're a quarter of the way there, well, you have a quarter of that, right? You've lost a quarter. Whatever percentage you are above sort of a normal level for you because you're stressed, that you're losing that cognitive functioning, which makes things like the prefrontal cortex, the best definition I've ever heard from it is Robert Sapolsky, who talks about it's the simulator. So what our brain, what our prefrontal cortex does is it allows us to go, if I say, hey, Ted, you want to jump off the building with me? Right? Let's go to your roof and jump off. See who hits the ground first. Like, you don't need to do that, right? Why don't you need to do that? you know that's a bad idea.
Simulation. Yeah.
Because right? You can run
if
that.
If all hit the ground.
You can run that and you can go, oh, let's see, that's that far. No, I'm gonna die if I do that. I don't wanna do that test. I don't wanna do that experiment. But you can do it with smaller things. What happens if I don't stick with my diet today? What happens if I blow off my exercise today? How likely am I to move towards the future that I envision for myself as being ideal if I don't have control over my behaviors, if I can't weigh the consequences of changing the plan, right? And then it also makes us more impulsive, just like fight or flight does, right? The more cortisol, the more stress hormones, the more impulsive you are. Which means
probably more impulsive to things that are not conducive to long-term success.
Right. Well, it's
right? To all those things.
Like just being stressed out, just having high stress hormones means you're more likely to have problems at work, right? You're more likely to have like behavioral, personality conflicts with work, and you're more likely to get fired. You're more likely to have an affair. You're more likely to cheat on your diet. You're more likely to speed. You're more likely to commit petty crimes. Like everything. So all the stuff that we know is like, we can say, man, I left my wallet in my car and I came in to get this drink and it's only a dollar. Like I'm just going to walk out to my car and get it. And I realize I don't have my wallet. Oh man, I could get my car and drive off. Right. Like that's huge moral conflict for some people. Some people it's like, that's right on the edge. And they're like, whatever. The more impulsive you are, the more likely you are to do the wrong thing in that situation, right? To have that one more flirtatious text with, whatever, somebody's wife or somebody who's not your wife or, something like that. I don't like any of these things. All bad decisions are based on this not working well. And some people have this in droves and some people are barely getting by with what they have anyway. And so you sleep deprive somebody, it makes a big difference. In fact, if you look at the symptomatology to diagnose ADHD or just ADD, and then you look at the symptomatology of chronic sleep deprivation, identical.
Similar, huh? Oh, identical.
Identical.
Wow.
Exactly.
Interesting.
Exactly the same. And in fact, when I was working with the SEALs, a lot of what they were reporting to me was prefrontal cortex stuff, right? Their motivation was down. Their ability to concentrate was down. Their focus, their attention, their memory, like everything was, they were struggling. They were having to leave their house 3 to 5 times before they even really got on the road to go to work because they realized they forgot something every time they got in their car. Like, they had to go back in their house and get something else, and then they miss a turn. On the same path they've taken to work, 5,000 times, and then they just don't feel motivated, but they're SEALs, right? So they're going to do it anyway. They just don't feel like doing it. They're like, man, I'd really like my life to not be pure drudgery, like nose to the grindstone every second. I'd like to actually enjoy some of this that I've set up for myself. One of the reasons that I so strongly believed that sleep was a major factor was because when I looked into the symptomatologies they had, which was way more catabolic than they should have been, way less anabolic, way higher stress hormones, body composition shifts that just had no justification, right? If you look like their nutrition and their training was spot on, and why weren't, and this was 2009, people weren't talking about sleep nearly like they are now. And I was literally laughed out of offices of leadership trying to tell them that I thought that sleep deprivation was affecting their performance and their hormones. And they're like, oh my God, sleep affects your hormones? Get out of here, you quack.
That's like, no, because like, they were sleep deprived.
So
couldn't think straight.
Yes. I mean, so all that's tied in. So to wrap all that up, like I'm harping on the four pillars that I've always harped on. And to address something you said kind of at the beginning of this conversation is the really good news is that I'm not seeing anything different. Like do the same things I'm still recommending the same things around sleep. I'm still recommending the same things around nutrition. I'm still recommending the same things around exercise. I'm still recommending the same things around stress mitigation, and just whatever that is. And for different people, that's different things. Some people are gadgety and they want to use some sort of heart math or, the whatever kind of devices they want to use, they really go ahead. Some people want to meditate, go ahead. Some people want to do Tai Chi, go ahead. Some people do slow flow yoga, go ahead. Like, I don't care. Whatever it is for you. Mindfulness training always works. Like, it's always a good place to start. Breath work always works. That's a good place to start. Mindfulness training is something as simple, I tell people, is just use your left hand or use your non-dominant hand for everything you do. That seems ridiculously simple, but it forces you to think about right now.
Right.
I can't think about, oh, I'm supposed to use my left hand to open that jar instead of, like, I'm supposed to do this. And it really feels weird brushing my teeth with my left hand. I can't think about that and be worried about coronavirus, right? I can't. Like, it makes you, it forces you into the now.
Hey, Kirk. I have a question, man. What you're saying is so important. You know, find what works for you. Do whatever type of mindfulness training, even using your left hand, do meditation, do yoga, do Tai Chi, whatever it is. I've got a question because we've talked a lot about sleep on this podcast. I've had you on, I've had other people on, I've shared some of what I found to be helpful. Some people though have problems, even though implementing blue light blocking glasses, they've got the blackout blinds, they've got their sleep dialed in, you know, to where they're going to bed and waking up at the same time. They're getting light exposure early in the morning. They're exercising. They're making sure their, you know, their carbohydrates aren't so low that it's affecting, you know, serotonin production, all these things, right?
Right.
What do you coach people on who are quote unquote doing everything right and still struggling to sleep?
So there are some nuances that unfortunately would just have to come to me by working with the patient, because, you know, I have a decade of experience of doing it. So there are some nuances that would be hard to communicate intelligently, at least. I would just be throwing random thoughts out there. But one thing that is almost always true, and when I say almost always, my, you know, pull it out of a hat number would be probably 90%+ of people who have difficulty sleeping, there's a significant stress component to it. And I would say,
agreed,
at least 90% of that 90%, stress is the primary component of it. So I talk a lot about how do you decrease stress. And of course, a lot of it has to do with perception of stress, which is something that they could work with a behavioral therapist. There's something called CBTI, so cognitive behavioral therapy, sure, for insomnia. That's basically narrative and reframing. It helps people, you know, spin, like we were talking about, the data's coming into all of us, what we're doing with the data. That's what CBT helps you with. Like, what story are you making out of that data? So that's one thing, and that's a little too protracted for me to sort of give advice on, because that would be me addressing every narrative you have around sleep. What works for the masses is to just decrease your individual stress about everything else. And mm-hmm. This even decreases your stress around the fear of not being able to sleep, and the guilt associated with not being able to sleep. And what I mean by that is, the most common reason for insomnia, by far the most common cause of insomnia, is something called psychophysiologic insomnia, which means that you can't sleep because you're worried about not being able to sleep. How do you get out of that rut, right? So CBT could help them with that mind shift, but it's usually bigger than that. Like, it's, you know, it's bigger, it's spinning kind of every narrative in your life. So what I tell people to do is, I say, first, we talk about what you and I just talked about. Fight or flight versus deep sleep, where your hormones, where your stress hormones, where your anabolic hormones, like, and so I convince them, hey, this is super important, right? And if you think about it, you know, if the normal curve is here and you're living up here and fight or flight is up here, well, the closer you are to that, the higher the cortisol is going to be throughout the day. And cortisol is what wakes you up in the morning. Cortisol is what's waking you up really early, and cortisol is what's getting in the way of you being able to fall asleep, because your cortisol level isn't low enough to fall asleep. But you're exhausted. You have other factors going into that, especially men. It'll allow men to have enough sleep pressure to get past that initial hurdle of having too much cortisol and too many wake-promoting neurotransmitters and other wake-promoting hormones. Those are too high, but there's so much sleep pressure built on top of that that they usually, they're able to sleep get through one deep cycle. Now they've cleared out enough of the sleep pressure hormones and byproducts, and now they wake back up because their cortisol levels are high enough to be awake. And what most people don't realize is that cortisol is actually your friend. You can't be alive without cortisol. But what cortisol does is it keeps you alert and awake in proportion to your environment. So if you're in fight or flight, you have a lot of cortisol. If it's 10 a.m. and you're laying on your couch reading a book, you have enough cortisol to be awake, but it's nowhere near the cortisol you would have if you were working out or, you know, whatever, driving in traffic, like all the sorts of other things. So cortisol proportionally keeps you awake to your environment. And I tell people a lot of times that the fight or flight system is like the immune system for what's outside of your body, right? Everything that's outside of you gets taken care of by stress hormones and providing you more resources to deal with things outside of your body. Once it gets inside of you, that's what we call the proper immune system. And you have to have resources to deal with things that are inside. The internal threat is different than the external threat. The external threat is handled by stress hormones. So going through a divorce is an external threat. Going through bankruptcy is an external threat. Being sequestered, quarantined for COVID is an external threat. The economy crashing is an external threat. These are all external things. Your immune system is not helping you with this. But you can't have both, right? When you're fighting your environment in fight or flight, you don't have an immune system. When your immune system is at its max, you can't fight your environment. So you got to balance this, right? You got to find that way to bring that down. So this is what I tell them. If I can get them to buy into that, I say, so we want to decrease your overall stress hormones for the full 24-hour period. Not just work, not just sleep, not just going to sleep, not just getting back to sleep. 24 hours a day, we want you to have fewer stress hormones. So one way we do that is by improving your sleep, ironically, because as I said, when you don't sleep enough, you have more stress hormones. And when you don't have more stress hormones, you have a harder time sleeping. So that's another self-propagating downward spiral we have to get ourselves out of. So what I tell people is this. I say, if you will admit, if you can make a pact with yourself that the most capable you will ever be at handling whatever stress is in front of you is after you've had a completely restorative night of sleep. If you can buy into that, then our focus is to get a completely restorative night of sleep, right? And you're not going to forget about, you're not going to blow anything off. What really intimidates people, I've found through years of consulting, is the fear that they're going to forget about something that they're afraid of, and they're going to make it worse because they didn't think about it enough, or they didn't take enough action on it. They didn't take it seriously enough. So here's what you do. You take a piece of paper, you draw a line straight down the middle. On one side, you write to do. On the other side, you write to worry. The to-do list, project it out as long as you're stressed for, right? If you're somebody who needs to know everything in the next year, have at it. If you're somebody that just needs to get through tomorrow, that's what you do. So the to-do list is actions, things that you can take action on that will make a difference. And even if you don't think it's a big thing, these aren't big things. This is everything. Trimming your toenails is on this list, right? Anything. If you look at stress, it's like a container, right? It's like, you think about it, it's like a cup, right? And so this cup fills up with stress. And once it starts overflowing, that's when you're dysfunctional. And it doesn't matter why it's overflowing. Yeah, maybe 70% of it is my divorce, right? But the other 31% that's causing that 1% to overflow is insignificant crap. So I can get rid of that 30% still too, right? And I won't overflow. I won't have excess stress hormones. So everything goes on the list, everything you can take action against. Read statistics, read academic statistics on coronavirus, look at history of other, respiratory viruses through academic sites. Like, those things are to-dos that you can take action on a current fear that otherwise seems like you don't really have any control over. You don't have any control over how communicable this is, but you do have control over how communicable you think this is and how communicable this is looking relative to what we've seen in the past. And those are actually comforting numbers when you look at this. It's like, this looks a lot like a lot of the other stuff we've had.
Right.
So, but your to-do list is also take out the trash and develop the homeschool program for the kids and go to the grocery store and cook dinner and, trim your toenails and everything else. All of that's still on the list. The to-do list, everything that you know you might think about in the middle of the night. The to-worry list, by contrast, is crap you have no control over whatsoever, but you're still going to worry about them. And people don't want to forget to have the opportunity to worry about things. So we're going to put that on the list too. And it's like, will the economy completely collapse? Will my company go bankrupt? Will I be unemployed? Well, like, okay. Some of that stuff you could do a little bit about. You could take some action and be like, well, I'm going to, you know, beef up my resume during this time off in case I get
fired. Oh, yeah.
But there's stuff that you're worrying about that you have no control over. And so make sure we put that down. Now, you take that piece of paper, have this piece of paper, have my list, and I say, okay, this contains all my stress. This contains all my external stresses in the world right here. I'm worried about my kid's mood. I'm worried about my finances. I'm worried about my mom's health. All things I don't have control. I'm worried about. Those are all stressors, though. And I'm worried about all this stuff I need to do. I can take care of that. Maybe that's intimidating. Maybe it's not. But this is everything I'm concerned about. Now, again, I reinforce. You do this when your brain's working well. You do this when you have low stress hormones. You sit down in the middle of the day. You have like a nice cup of tea or whatever your thing is. You relax and you write this list. And then you say, the best I'm ever going to be at handling this intimidating list is after I've slept well, after I've been completely restored. And of course, to have taken care of myself in every other way to get good sleep and to have the full optimization of my body's ability. So I'm going to eat well. I'm going to exercise well. I'm going to do my best to control my stress during the day. When I feel myself stressed, I'm going to use techniques that de-stress me, and exercise is one of those. It can be, you know, potentially one of those things. And so I'm going to handle this only after I sleep. Like, I'm not allowed to handle it before. I'm not allowed to handle it at bedtime. I'm not allowed to handle it when I wake up in the middle of the night. So once you have that contract and you're like, this is something you do with yourself, like, all right, if I completely convince myself that I want to handle this when I'm at my best, I'm going to get a good night's sleep. So now how do I get a good night's sleep? Well, I keep this by my bedside, right? I set an alarm clock. This is all the same normal sleep hygiene stuff. I set an alarm clock an hour before it's time to go to bed. In that hour before it's time to go to bed, I get rid of worries. I'm not allowed to think about anything on this list during that time. I'm not allowed to take action. If I've forgotten something, I can add something to that list. But I'm not allowed to take any action on this list. And my sole job is to get my brain and body ready to go to sleep so that I can wake up restored and handle my list. That's all I'm doing. After that alarm clock goes off at 9 p.m. or whatever, that's all I'm doing until I'm going to sleep at 10. All I'm doing is getting ready for bed. Anything that's not conducive, lights, stimulation, all the stuff you know, all the stuff you're talking about, they're doing everything right. Now they get in bed. They have another alarm clock. You have two alarm clocks equally as important. Even if you don't think you need an alarm clock to wake up, you have an alarm clock to wake up. And that alarm clock wakes you up 8 hours after you should be asleep, or 8 hours after you have the initial opportunity to go to sleep. So I've spent from 9 to 10 getting ready for bed. I get into bed 5 minutes, 10 minutes before 10, whatever, 10 o'clock. And in the next 10 or 15 minutes, I fall asleep. I don't get out of bed. I don't even look at a clock until that morning alarm clock goes off, because it doesn't matter what time it is. It doesn't matter how much I've slept. It doesn't actually matter if I'm sleeping or not, because the next best thing that I can do if I'm not sleeping is to decrease my stress. And I can do that through breathing exercises. I can do that through visualization. I can do that through guided visualization, guided meditation, progressive muscle relaxation, breath work. There's all sorts of stuff that I can do, lay in my bed and keep my eyes closed, and I can just work on relaxing. Now, because I don't know what time it is, my alarm clock could go off 10 minutes after I start all this, right? And then I got 7 hours and 50 minutes of sleep and 10 minutes of meditation. Good to go. If my alarm clock's not going to go off for 3 or 4 hours and I'm laying there just focused on relaxing, decreasing my stress hormones, not allowing myself to think about anything on this list, because I'm going to handle that when that morning alarm clock goes off, then I can start thinking about this list. Right now, all I'm doing is decreasing stress. Sleep is the best way to decrease stress. But if I'm not sleeping, I'm doing other things that are my second, third best way to decrease stress. And I'm going to lay there and keep decreasing my stress hormones until my alarm clock goes off. There's no way you're going to do that for 3 hours. You're going to fall asleep. maybe you might do it for an hour. Like, I don't know. You might do it for 15 minutes, might do it for 5 minutes. I mean, plenty of times I wake up and I teach this stuff for a living, man. I have plenty of times I wake up and I'm like, man, I know it's like 3 a.m. and I got so much to do. And, you know, I'm getting up at 5 anyways. Maybe I should just get up. I don't know. And like, and then I just don't feel like I can go to sleep, man. I'm so wide awake. And I, you know, and I have to take my own advice.
You struggle with it too. Yeah.
To have any sort of integrity, I have to take my own advice. And I'm like, all right, well, I'm going to lay here and meditate. And I know I'm not falling back asleep. And I don't even remember meditating. I fall asleep so fast. It's like, bam, just I'm out like a light. And the alarm clock's going off. I'm like, ah, there it goes again. Yeah.
Yeah, great, great advice. Great practical advice. And for those of you who are really seriously committed to stepping up during this time or to any time where you're under pressure and having stress-related loss of sleep, this is, man, this is pure gold. Thank you so much for sharing this with me, Kirk. Listen, I want to be respectful of your time. I feel like we could have this conversation for hours, or at least I could keep asking you questions and learning. I'm having such a great time catching up with you and, you know, it, love your perspective and, you know, how you understand this and this, what's happening with this situation and also what to do about it. We've got to do a follow-up.
Yeah, for sure.
Soon.
Absolutely. But, sooner than 5 years.
Yeah, no kidding. Well, we've tried. It's just been, it's been a little bit of ups and downs. I know you were super busy and then I've been traveling and, Kirk, where's, so you have a sleep supplement. People can also work with you if they're having struggles and they're looking for an expert to help them through it. Where's the best place
not currently. I have a waiting list for that. People can get on the waiting list if they want to. We can give you some information about what it looks like to work with me, and then you can get on a waiting list if you want, if it's that, you know, if it's that important to work with me specifically. Otherwise I can help you find someone in your area, or my team can help you find someone in your area. So if you go to Doc Parsley, just DOC, short for doctor, Doc, P-A-R-S-L-E-Y, like the herb, docparsley.com. The shop on there has my supplement, all the information about my supplement, if that's what you're interested in. There's blogs, there's videos, there's other people's podcasts. We'll throw your podcast on there. This podcast will be on there if you guys agree to that and want to do that. You know, whatever information resources I have are on there. And then there's ways to get in touch with me and whatever, schedule, like request lectures, whatever you want to do. Like that's the best way, best resource there.
Excellent. DocParsley.com. That will be on the show notes for this episode. Kirk, man, it's such a pleasure to connect with you again. And
likewise.
We will definitely make it much sooner than later. So thank you so much. And, just appreciate you, appreciate what you bring, and looking forward to it again, man.
Yeah, thanks for the opportunity to just get on my soapbox and preach, man. Appreciate it.
That wraps up another episode of the Legendary Life Podcast, and I know that was a bit of a dense one and a long one, but hopefully you have a new perspective, not only on how to get better sleep, even if you're doing everything right and it's still not working for you because of the stress level that we're all currently under, but also how to interpret the information about the coronavirus and put it into the proper context. So I'm not gonna take a lot of time here, but I will say and remind you again what I said at the beginning. We're launching a 7-day challenge. It's my way of giving back. If you want to take your results to the next level, not just in 7 days, but beyond, you wanna join this challenge. LegendaryLifePodcast.com/challenge. But there are only 50 spots available. And again, you're going to be expected to show up and do the work, or you will not last in the challenge. But if you commit to doing it, if you're committed to making a change, if you're coachable and you're tired of your hand in the Cheetos bag and binge watching Netflix, actually, my hand is more in the ice cream, the Oreos, cookies and cream ice cream cake personally. But if you're looking to make that change and you're up for a challenge, go to legendarylivepodcast.com/challenge and join. Have an amazing week, and I'll speak to you on Friday.